Presenting a proven way to build your endowment with a sustainable gift planning program, this is the Gift Planning Development Podcast, an ongoing forum designed to help you meet all of your gift planning goals.
It's the Gift Planning Development Vlogcast, and I am your host, Joe Tumalo, CEO of Gift Planning Development. And we created these vlogcasts and podcasts to bring you some of the best minds, thought leaders in the business to help you be more effective in your fundraising. Today is no exception. I am so grateful and pleased to have my wonderful guest, Andrea Kilstedt. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, our fans are in for a treat. You've got lots of great ideas. You have, in my estimation, that wonderful combination of strategy, expertise, technical expertise, and the EQ. So IQ and EQ, right? Strong EQ, your sensitivity, your empathy, your compassion, your ability to really listen and be present and to help bring out, help people articulate what they're feeling, which I think is huge in fundraising. And I don't think enough people talk about the EQ, the above the line stuff, as I call it.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah. And so we are clearly, this is October of 2020, and we are still in the midst of a pandemic, and everyone's world has changed and turned upside down. And I think this, if there's anything positive that comes out of this, it forces us to really reevaluate how we do business, and both from a consultant standpoint and as fundraisers and leaders of nonprofits. And, you know, we do this work for a while and we build up our skill sets and we get good at it. And then we feel like, all right, as long as I just maybe stay here or try to get a little better and just be open to ideas, but keep doing the same thing. Well, that only lasts for so long, as we see now, that sometimes change is thrust upon us. And so in the fundraising consulting world, which is where Andrea and I hang out and make our living, we know clearly that things are changing rapidly. And Andrea and her partner, Amy Eisenstein, very wisely, and this is before pandemic, reinvented their world, their business, and the way that we think about fundraising consulting specific to capital campaigns. And all my capital campaign consultant friends are going to be like, what are you guys doing? You're trying to put me out of business, right? But I think it fills an incredible need, incredible niche. You've got, 1.4 million charities out there, most of which are not in a position to hire, spend $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a month for a consultant, right? I'm going to shut up and let you talk in a minute, Andrea, right? And there's a clear need for what you're doing. Do you want to tell folks what you're doing?
Oh, Joe, I'd be delighted to do that. First of all, it's so interesting to look at what my partner, Amy Eisenstein and I have done through the lens of the pandemic, because we began working on this 3 or 4 years ago, right? This is not pandemic related for us. And if I were to look back and say, well, when did it begin? I spent a lot of my life as a traditional consultant. From 1984 on, I was a traditional consultant. I had a successful regional consulting practice. And there were things about the consulting practice, capital campaign consulting practice, that troubled me, but I didn't start to pay them a lot of attention until everybody was getting all of their material and information on the web. So I began to think, when the medical profession, for example, began to change, or the legal profession, or the accounting profession, when all of these professions, right? And what is a profession? Profession is when someone holds tight a set of information and dribbles it out in exchange for money, right? That's a profession in some way. So it used to be that, you know, that we would go to the, when your shoulder hurt, you would make a call and make a doctor's appointment and pay dearly to go to the doctor's office, and he would look at your shoulder and tell you what to do. Well, today, Joe, if you had a shoulder pain, that's going to the doctor, calling the doctor is not the first thing you would do, right?
No.
What would you do first?
take ibuprofen?
Yeah, but also you'd go to the web. You'd go to WebMD, or you would type in and you'd do a Google search for shoulder pain, right? And then you'd look at five or six sites and you'd see what they told you to do. And you say, oh, well, I can do this. Now I'm going to take ibuprofen for a while, right? It's likely to make it better. The same is true with the legal profession, right? If somebody has to make a will today, well, you may call your attorney first, but you may also go to LegalZoom. And for way less money, simply download a form, and you can also get advice from them online to redo your will, right? It's inexpensive and effective. And that made me begin to think, that shift more generally made me begin to think that it was high time for capital campaign consultants to shift in a similar way. That there was really no more excuse for high-priced capital campaign consultants who doled out little by little information about capital campaigns and charged many thousands of dollars for doling out that information. And I thought, all right, why should capital campaign consulting, that profession, be any different from the others? Let me see what I can do. And I teamed up with Amy Eisenstein, and we created something called the Capital Campaign Toolkit, which provides a remarkable online library of material organized, designed and organized in a simple, effective, usable way. And it pairs those with virtual access to excellent consultants. I mean, honestly, I have some of the most experienced, some of the best advisors for nonprofits around capital campaign consulting anywhere. These are people who, like me, have deep experience in the capital campaign business. So once we said, 3 years ago, we said we can do all of this virtually. Zoom existed. Actually, I don't know if we started out with Zoom or something else, maybe Google Hangouts or something. But, there's no reason for us to travel the country and spend whole days, traveling and whole days sitting in our clients' offices. When in fact, even if we did that, they do the work. Right? We consultants don't do the work. I mean, unless you're hiring someone to serve as an interim, development person, we don't do the work. We just tell people what to do and advise them. So the Capital Campaign Toolkit started about 3 years ago in earnest. We created a wonderful online site. We got some amazing campaign advisors. And now a short 3 years later, and of course in the heart of COVID, and now everybody is Zooming, we have clients in 33 states and 4 countries. We cover every segment of the nonprofit world, from small social service organizations or humane leagues or Boys and Girls Clubs or universities or food banks or health foundations, or, I mean, you name it, we're working with it. We're even working for some big associations, some big professional associations. And, in the first couple of years, it was like, well, can you really do business online? Can you really do business through Zoom? And guess what? Today, no one asks us that anymore. We were a bit ahead of our time, and we indeed see a great increase in our business. It's a wonderfully effective way to provide consulting services, and it works really well.
And so what's the impact that you see? You've been doing it enough now to see, well, let us think about that. Have you been doing it long enough to actually have any campaigns finish?
Yeah, right? It takes, it often takes about 2 to 3 to 4 years for a capital campaign to go from beginning to end. So we have some campaigns that are moving along very well. We have one that is coming close to an end. We have worked with organizations to do a bunch of what we call guided feasibility studies, where they do the interviews and we provide serious guidance. Those have been incredibly successful. And we decided that we would see if we could truncate the model and offer programs for eight-week campaign programs, right? So we thought, what if we took the secret sauce ingredients of a capital campaign and put it together in an 8-week program? And we started that in the spring, and we're doing another group this fall. In our spring program, we had 16 organizations. It was to raise $100,000 or more in 8 weeks through the method of capital campaigns. In the first program, right, of those 16, I think 13 of them had raised their goal or more by the end of the program, and the others were on their way. And we're seeing the same kind of results this time. So we're tinkering and playing with the model. We're putting it, you know, in short chunks, in group forms. We are having big, fully framed campaigns, providing virtual assistance and online support. We provide group advising. Every Wednesday, we have a group of people who come on with us and we talk about their questions. And it's really remarkable. We live at a remarkable time where this kind of service can be available. And I think it's because I just have a restless mind that I came up with it. Amy and I came up with it before anybody else did.
That's great. You said something there which gave me pause, is the fundraisers or leadership are doing the feasibility interviews?
Yes, that's a big deal, right?
Yeah, and how do they, of course, the big question is objectivity, right?
Yes. So that's, of course, what every consultant will tell you.
Yeah.
And when I was a consultant and I did many interviews, right, it's I remember wondering if that was the right approach. Think about it this way, Joe. The relationship that you really want to build is between the leadership of the organization and the donors, right? That's really the relationship you want to build. So when some of, you know, I've been in this business a long time, and if you're in this business a long time, you tend to make friends with people who are wealthy. Mm-hmm. So I had a couple of my, you know, philanthropist friends call me up and say, "Hey, Andrea, you're good at thinking about doing things in different ways. I hate it when I have to talk to these consultants and their checklists." I said, "I'd much rather talk to the people in the organization. Can't you figure out how to change up the model so it works?" So I spent a long time trying to sort that out. And here's what I finally realized. And it was I'm sure it will surprise you as it surprised me. So let's say, Joe, that you are a capital campaign consultant and you go out to talk to an organization hires you to do a feasibility study. You go out to talk to one of their largest donors. You say to that donor, "Listen, our conversation is confidential, right? I will not go back with information specifically about this conversation. I will collate them." And that's why consultants think that donors are going to talk to them honestly, right? Because they can do it in confidence. So the donor says, "Fine," and you have a conversation, and towards the end of the conversation, because the bad stuff always happens at the end of a conversation, the donor says to you, "Joe, you know, I have some real problems with the way this organization functions. I don't think that they handle their investments well or whatever it is. And, you know, and I'm sort of concerned about this person or that person or this practice." And you write it down, you know, in your notes, and you say, "Thank you very much. I'm so happy you were willing to share this with me." And back you go. All right. Now you are sworn to confidentiality. So you can't go back to your organization and say, "Hey, executive director, this donor is concerned about such and such. In fact, they're concerned about your leadership, right? This and that about your leadership issues." You can't do that, right? So you can't get a conversation going between the organization. You can't get the organization to make a difference with this donor. And on the other side, think about it from the donor's perspective, right? You have gotten the donor to think about the things that are wrong, but the donor then has nowhere to go with that. You have left them fresh with having articulated a problem, right? So I thought to myself, this is not good, right? It's not good for the donor to be left with a problem and no recourse for it. And it's not good for the organization to know generally somebody doesn't agree with this, but not to know who to talk to begin to work it out. So I thought to myself, this whole model is lousy, right? And the follow-up in my mind was this. If I go to you, Joe, if I'm an executive director and I go to you as a donor and I say, "You know, Joe, we're doing a series of interviews. I'm doing a series of interviews to try to understand how people really feel about this organization. And we want the good, the ugly, the bad. We want to talk about everything, because if we can't find out from you what your concerns are, we can't work on them," right? So I hope in the next hour you'll be able to share what you love and share what you don't love so we can actually get to work on them. Are you going to tell me what you really think?
Absolutely.
You are. Of course you are.
Yeah. Right.
So I said, this is ridiculous. This consultant model is ridiculous. It doesn't build the relationship between the donor and the organization the way it should. It leaves the donor stuck with whatever lousy feelings the consultant managed to unearth. And it doesn't give the organization an opportunity to go back to the donor and begin to work on things that might be wrong. Three counts, right? Three strikes, yeah. Out.
And so from the executive director leadership standpoint, they need to be willing to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
I've been watching a lot of Brené Brown stuff, yes. And she just really has me thinking about vulnerability, right? Yeah. I think people, if fundraisers don't ask, either they don't think about it to ask, they're afraid to ask, they're afraid of the answers.
Right. That's right.
Right. And so it's a vulnerability. I think maybe that's just
but we can teach them to do that. I mean, we've created a whole model of how a conversation flows that will help the executive director be able to have those real conversations. And of course, those are the conversations that strengthen the relationship. It's not the ones where they're trying to sell. It's the ones where they're saying, Joe, what do you think? We could really use your wisdom and your outside objectivity, right? I really want to know what's on your mind for us. Because then if you tell me something, I can say, well, would you serve on a committee to help us sort this out? We're hearing this from a number of people. Mm. We need to do something about it, right? All of that's good.
Yeah, I keep thinking of a marriage, having been married for 30 years. How long have you been married? You've been married a bit, yes?
52.
52, awesome. Great. Right. And so, and I'm not saying anyone that gets a divorce or is in a bad marriage or bad people, but, and at the same time, I think it's, you can either have a crappy marriage and be miserable and stay together, do nothing about it. You can get a divorce or you can work on it. Right.
That's right.
And so I think, or you can have not even a crappy marriage, but just like an okay,
right.
It's fine. Another thought leader I watch a fair amount, Mel Robbins, she says, don't stop using the F word. Fine. Everything is fine. How's your marriage? It's fine. Right. Well, life is too short, I think, to just have a fine marriage. So if we have a fine marriage and my wife and I, Lorraine and I, don't really discuss things, I don't come to her and say, how can I be a better partner, better husband? We can just coexist. Right. But when I do that behavior of, can we sit down and talk about it? I really want to check in with you. How am I doing? What can I be doing to improve? Right. That does strengthen the relationship, the marriage so much.
Yeah. Yeah. It sure does.
It's that vulnerability. I don't think a lot of people do that in relationship, personal relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't get a lot of practice in doing that. And all the more important that we really work on it.
Yeah. You know?
The other thing we've learned with these guided feasibility studies is that one of the reasons organizations do feasibility studies is to give their board the confidence that they can actually go into a campaign. So it took a while to wrestle with that. Say, all right, once you've done all the interviews, then the executive director isn't going to have the same kind of credibility when they go to the board with the results. So we said, well, what if we partner with the executive director or the leadership team and help them craft the report, and then we co-present the report with them, right? Which is what we do. And that, of course, gives the board confidence that somebody actually who is seasoned and experienced has been a part of this process and sort of gives the process of a stamp of a seal of approval. So it took a while to figure that part out.
So it sounds like, you're probably doing, providing much more service than even some consultants, and that there's really not a lot of difference other than the price tag.
That's right.
The end result,
right? Right. The end result, I honestly think the end result is better.
Yeah.
And among other things, we, many consulting firms, when they bring on consultants, associated consultants, are getting people who are younger in the field, right? Who don't have as much experience. Well, it turns out that there are a fair number of people who are heading towards my age who have been in the business a long time, who are tired of running their own businesses, who are tired of schlepping around the country, who are tired of doing full-on feasibility studies. So, you know, I know a lot of people in this business. Yeah. So when I started reaching out to them saying, hey, how would you like to come and be part of our team? They grabbed at it. They're happy with their grandchildren, having fun with their grandchildren. They're happy staying at home, and they're happy sharing this remarkable amount of expertise with clients in a way that is easier from their perspective. So we have blended, you know, the remarkable expertise of people who have been in the business 20, 30 years with a more efficient and effective way for organizations to get what they need, both in terms of advising and information.
It's great. Really, really smart. Yeah.
It's my swan song in this business, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, I know you'll find something else after this. I know. So does everyone pay the same rate? Do you have different levels of support?
Yeah, we do it all on a month-to-month basis. It's a subscription service. We have what we call an essentials level, where people actually get access to the full toolkit, and they get it all at once, right? We don't dribble out information. You get the whole batch of information, and those people get a weekly group call led by an advisor with other organizations, 3, 4, 5 organizations that are doing campaigns. So a chance to come together with a peer group. That's the basic level. It's $750 a month. Then when people are ready, they move up to actually having an assigned advisor, right? And we have different levels of that. It ranges from, I think, $19.50 a month to help with pre-campaign planning or the quiet phase of the campaign. And it bumps up some for a guided feasibility study, because we are very much present through that process. And then it jumps back down, pops back down. So we don't operate on long-term contracts like standard consultants do, right? For us, you don't do a year-long or a two-year-long contract. It's like you start out at one level. When you need more, you bump up. When you're comfortable, you know what you're doing, you bump down, right? It's just, and usually there's a pattern to it, right? People need more upfront early in the process, and then gradually they can sort of feather out and get only what they need. We also do online board training, online solicitation training, executive coaching. This is a new offering for us, because we find that executive directors are often out of their league when it comes to fundraising and are dying for someone on the outside to advise them. Hmm. So we do some of that. And now I'm just beginning to have fun playing with this idea of improv coaching. So do you see that, Joe? I sort of floated that in the
there. I saw yesterday.
I said to people, you know, you should really, if you're going to be a really good solicitor, you should really study improv, right? Because that's the perfect thing to do. And I said, you know, if you're interested, shoot me an email. Well, much to my astonishment, we got more than 100 people shooting me an email.
No kidding.
Wow. Now today and tomorrow, I'm talking to people from Second City in Chicago and from the Magnet Theater in here in New York.
Oh my goodness.
Trying to find out what the options are, what we might put together. So that'd be fun.
And I use that in a lot of my workshops, the yes and.
Yes, yes, and.
Mindset.
Yes,
you notice earlier when I was about to say but, I said and.
Yes.
Right? So that's been ingrained. Yes. Yeah, the yes and, just as a quick, if folks are not familiar with that, just Google or go to YouTube and look for yes and. And it really is a mindset, not only with dealing with people, but just personally as well, right? Is to not, like, I had a tendency to resist a lot, especially when I was younger. New ideas that weren't consistent. I mean, it could be something silly, going to the opera, right? Oh, who would want to sit for 3 hours of that?
Right.
Right. And then after taking a couple of improv, I took a summer, and I had zero background in theater, nothing at all. It wasn't never in a play in school or anything, but someone told me years ago, especially when I was going to start speaking, take an acting class, take an improv class. And I did both, and they were incredibly helpful, not just for speaking, but again, just working with people, working with groups, working with employees
you're really good at it now. You do these amazing calls, right? It was so interesting to hear about those, where you are really right. I mean, the deal with improv is that you have to be in the moment and you have to be willing to listen. Those are the two primary things. And I tell you, if all of us did more of that in our daily lives and in our solicitation calls, they would all go better.
And not resist, right? And not,
resist. That's right.
That's not going to work or whatever it is. Yeah.
You know, so, I had a wonderful father. I just have to add this to the, I had a terrific father. I was fortunate to have a wonderful guy as a father. And one of the things that he said to me numerous times as I was growing up is, he said, Andrea, when you have an opportunity to do something, unless you have a really good reason to say no, say yes. Mm. And that has stuck with me. I think that's really wise advice, to have yes as your default and not no, right? And there are times when you should say no, when there is a good reason to say no, and you should for sure do that. But when yes is your default, I tell you, life goes more smoothly.
That's beautiful. What did your father do?
He was a mechanical engineer. He was an immigrant from Hungary and just a nice, wise man. He really was.
And you're a New Yorker?
Yep, I am. Mm-hmm. I am. I live in New York here. I have two grown daughters and four grandkids, and I feel fortunate. I do feel fortunate.
Well, we thank you for sharing your gifts and continuing to break the mold and look for different ways of the same old thing.
See, Joe, you asked me to do this and I had to say yes, because I had no good reason to say no.
Well, thank you for doing it. And we have a couple things to plug. Your book, just happen to have a copy here.
Yeah, look at that. Thank you.
Right. Main strategies that work. What a concept. Strategies that work, right?
Strategies that work. I don't think anybody reads books like that anymore, do they? I don't know.
It's a big one.
It's a big one. 400 and some odd pages.
Well, you know, it's a reference book. I use it as
a reference book.
I use it as a reference book.
Exactly.
Would you sit down and read the whole thing?
No.
It would be, yeah, but it's a reference book. You have a question, boom. Right? We need these on the show. And the website for
CapitalCampaignToolkit.com.
I'm sorry, I stepped on your line.
CapitalCampaignToolkit.com.
CapitalCampaignToolkit.com. Okay. Anything else? And they can get in touch with you through, or Amy through
the
website?
They can get in touch with me through at Andrea@CapitalCampaignToolkit.com.
Cool. It's simple. Anything else?
Anything else? I don't know.
Okay. I want to leave you with a quote. I want to do my James Lipton.
Good. Okay.
About acting. All right. Yes. Inside the Actors Studio.
Yes.
There's a quote attributed to Peter Drucker, who was a business management guru out of California. And he said that culture eats strategy for lunch. Culture eats strategy for lunch. So we talk about strategies, right? And a lot of consultants talk about strategy, and strategy is important. One of the frustrations I've had in my consulting business is, because most of my work is plan giving, the people that hire me get it. Their bosses, their board don't always get it. So it's like, I can give you all the strategy in the world, but if you guys aren't all on board to create a change, to affect a change, it's not going to happen, right? So do you run into that on your side? With campaigns, maybe it's different because you have a timeline, a goal, and it's much more a sense of urgency. With plan giving, it's like, well, we may never see these gifts anyway, or if we do, it could be 20, 30 years. So maybe it's a different dynamic, but
yeah.
Response for that.
I think that actually points to why I have been in the capital campaign business all these years, right? I have little patience for that sort of yes, but, right? Can't do it now. It's not going to pay off. I am not wired to have patience for that. And in the capital campaign business, usually something big is pushing the capital campaign. There's something big happening that's making them take a big leap. And it puts whole organizations in a position where they are willing to take risks and they are willing to step forward in a big way, because, you know, they're going to lose their building. They can't carry out their functions. I mean, something big is generally happening, and it makes organizations much more fluid. It changes the culture, right? And takes this culture that is often stuck and loosens it up for a little bit of time. And that's when I enter. It suits me temperamentally to function that way, because I'm not patient. And it is fun. I often begin my work with organizations by encouraging them to do a blue sky session, to do a planning session that says, if money were no object, what would you be doing, right? How would you be carrying out your mission better than this? What would you need in order to do that, right? How can you wrap your arms around the need that you serve in your community and being able to do to serve that need much more effectively, right? And that gets people, that starts to light people up. And then, of course, you can say, well, with a capital campaign, you can raise multiples of what you raise to build your capacity to that or to some portion of that. So that's what makes my particular part of the fundraising business interesting and tolerable and exciting.
That's great. Good stuff as always, Andrea. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. I so appreciate it. And I appreciate you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. For more information on any of the topics you've heard about today, please go to giftplanningdevelopment.com.